This is a story of faith and compromise, of hope and disillusionment, of a God looked for but hidden. This is an ancient story of a time 2,500 years ago, and a world ruled by the God Emperor, Xerxes. Yet this is a story that speaks directly to our world today. It's a story of a man called to follow the true God, yet defined by a false one, and of a woman struggling to reconcile two competing identities. This is their story. This is our story.
Evening, everyone. It's great to see you. Good evening to our online community, particularly good evening and welcome to our online community, one of whom contributed the voiceover to that trailer. Which means you can still be involved with Metro, even if you're not here physically in the building. But for those of you that are here, it's great to be able to speak with you. This is part one in Esther. Who do you think you are? Now, with Metro, very often when we do our preaching, we have different kinds of styles. We have a different diet that we try to mix up so that we are just having a good balanced intake. So sometimes we'll do life application stuff. So we'll look at how to do issues of life. Sometimes we'll look straight at Gospels and Jesus and focus straight in on a heavy emphasis on the life of Jesus. But then sometimes we'll do stuff which is more Bible knowledge to give us a good overarching view of Scripture. It's really important that we have a good picture of the whole of the Bible, not just the kind of the good bits that we come back to time and time again. So we're doing the book of Esther. Now, Esther is a controversial book. The reformer Martin Luther, who started the Protestant church by accident, he said, I hate the book of Esther. And the reason that he gave that he didn't like it was he said, it's too full of much pagan naughtiness. And when I heard that phrase, pagan naughtiness, I thought, we need to do a study on Esther. Because that sounds right up our street. It's very, very Metro. So we're going to look at this book of Esther. It's controversial because not only did Luther hate it, but other people down through the years have actually wondered whether or not it should be included at all in the Bible because it doesn't mention the word God. It seems to have more in common with Game of Thrones than it does with Scripture. There's all kinds of palace intrigue and sex and betrayal and impalings and all that kind of good stuff. Heathen, pagan naughtiness. So if you are able, I would really encourage you to be reading the book of Esther. Alan's got really excited about it. He can't wait to go home and read the whole thing. Put your hands up if you've read the book of Esther before. Okay, great. A lot of people here. But for a lot of us, it's not something that we've come across. And you can ask yourself the question, why? I mean, why read a book that is 2,500 years old? What relevance does that have to my life today? What relevance does that have to my concerns? I mean, it's nice to know the Bible story, but what's it got to do with the price of fish? Why do we look at it? The reason we look at story, and just FYI, 43% of all Scripture is stories. So nearly a half of all the Bible is stories. And we look at books like Esther because it is a story in which we see the struggles, the challenges, the lives, the choices of people who live out their faith to one degree or another. And when we see their stories, we get to see our story. And actually, a book like Esther, if we understand it correctly, has more in common with our life and our experience than we might think. So tonight, what we're doing is we're launching the ship. We're pushing out. This is part one. Everyone say part one. In other words, don't hate me if you come to the end of this message and you think, hang on a minute, you've not resolved anything. It's a bit like the Lord of the Rings, the Fellowship of the Ring. It sort of ends with a like, and then what happened? But it's a part one. And next week, we're going to come and we're going to start to develop it a little bit further. But we need to give a little bit of context and understanding in order to get the best out of this book. This is a book that's set 2,500 years ago in the kingdom of Persia. So we'll start up very quickly at verse 1, chapter 1. It says, this is what happened during the time of Xerxes. The Xerxes who ruled over 127 provinces stretching from India to Kush. So the Persian Empire, 127 provinces, that's from Sudan, Egypt, the Near East, the Middle East, Turkey, Eastern Europe, through to the Gulf States, Arabia, to Afghanistan, Pakistan. So you've got that whole kind of Persian, Iran, Iraq. It's this vast empire, the greatest empire the world has ever seen. And it's ruled by this guy, Xerxes. Now, historically, Xerxes would be a guy that looked very Persian with a big, big beard. That's how they rocked it in those days. But our pop culture reference for Xerxes, he looks a bit more like this. Anyone recognize this guy? From the film 300. All the guys shout out 300. The women go, oh, for goodness sake, so juvenile. But 300 was a film. It was a fictional retelling of the historical action, the Battle of Thermopylae. The 300 Spartans who stood arrayed against the Persian army. A million Persians versus 300 Spartans in the hot gates, in this narrow pass that the Spartans managed to hold for enough time for the Greeks to rally and eventually win the war. But the Persians outnumbered them vastly, and they said, our arrows will block out the sun. And the Greeks replied, well then, we shall fight in the shade. Those guys were so cool. But Xerxes, he didn't really look like this, but in 300, he looks like this. Why? Because you want to get the sense of a guy who is insanely powerful, incredibly intimidating, worshipped literally as a god with a very, very uncomfortable collar piece, but someone that is terrifying, powerful, magnificent, ornate, and larger than life. That was Xerxes. So it goes on. It says, at that time, King Xerxes reigned from his royal throne in the citadel of Susa. And in the third year of his reign, he gave a banquet for all his nobles and officials. The military leaders of Persia and Media, the princes and the nobles of the provinces were present. For a full 180 days, he displayed the vast wealth of his kingdom. So this is like a six-month festival, fair, expo of his great wealth and the splendor and glory of his majesty. When these days were over, the king gave a banquet lasting 7 days in the enclosed garden of the king's palace for all the people, from the least to the greatest, who were in the citadel of Susa. The citadel of Susa is really important. The garden had hangings of white and blue linen, fastened with cords of white linen and purple material to silver rings on marble pillars. There were couches of gold and silver. Couches, not coins, couches. Fantastically, fabulously wealthy, very uncomfortable, but you get the gist. It's a massive flex. Gold, silver, couches. On a mosaic pavement of porphyry, marble, mother of pearl, and other costly stones. Wine was served in goblets of gold, each one different from the other, and the royal wine was abundant in keeping with the king's liberality. By the king's command, each guest was allowed to drink without restriction, for the king instructed all the wine stewards to serve each man what he wished. You have this opening of Esther, and it is mind-blowing. I mean, it is just spine-tingling. The wealth, the power, the fabulous opulence, the liberality of the king. And it's like Persia saying to the entire known world, look at how great we are. Look at how wonderful our life is. Look at what a great culture we've created. Look at what mighty things that we have done. And the Bible records this all, but then it goes one step further and says, yes, you have all this wealth, you have all this opulence, you have all this lavish extravagance, but not all is right. Not all is good with everybody. It then goes on. It says, Queen Vashti also gave a banquet for the women, So the men had one banquet, 7 days. The women had another in the royal palace of King Xerxes. On the seventh day, when King Xerxes was in high spirits, in other words, a complete drunken buffoon, high spirits from wine, he commanded the 7 eunuchs who served him, Mehuman, Bizthar, Harbona, Bigthar, Abagthar, Zithar, and Carcass, to bring before him Queen Vashti wearing her royal crown in order to display her beauty. Isn't that a great thing, ladies? When a drunken man wants to objectify you in front of all his friends, hashtag relationship goals. In order to display her beauty to the people and nobles, for she was lovely to look at. But when the attendants delivered the king's command, Queen Vashti refused to come. Then the king became furious and burned with anger. So what's going on here? How on earth is this at all relevant to modern day life? What on earth has this got to do with the price of fish? How does a gold couch impact my life? How does purple linen and all this talk of goblets and wine and the citadel of Susa, what's that got to do with me? But actually, if we take a look and rewind over those verses that we've read together, you actually realize that the culture of Persia is not too different to the culture that we experience today. You see, there was a number of different things that we've just kind of highlighted in those verses. First of all, it was pluralistic. Everyone say pluralistic. Pluralistic means it was a kind of enlightened culture. It was a progressive culture. We hear that Xerxes reigned from all over, from Africa right through to India, 127 provinces. But he did it in the time in a kind of enlightened way. Every other empire, and this was the greatest empire by far that the world had ever seen. This was the empire that conquered every other empire. But before then, the empire model was, we come and we destroy your culture. We destroy your gods. You serve these idols, we demolish them. So if you're a little tribe in Mesopotamia, we come, we conquer you, and you serve the lizard god no longer. Now you're serving our gods. We displace your gods, we put our gods in place. We displace your culture, we put our culture in place. But a pluralistic culture and society says there's space for everybody. Anybody can have what they have been used to. So if you used to serve and worship the lizard god, that's fine, that's great. It's a valid choice. It's your truth. We embrace it. We want to make space for it. All you've got to do is just make it one amongst many, plural. A singular god amongst a plurality of gods. And that's very much the culture that we live in today. Our culture is big on tolerance. It's big on inclusivity. It's big on allowing anybody to do and to believe what they want. You can believe Christianity. Be a Christian, that's fine. Or if you want to be into mindfulness, that's fine for you. You're a Hindu, you're a Sikh, you're a Muslim. Great, namaste. You want to go into New Age, or you want to go into meditation, or you want to follow Kim Kardashian, whatever floats your boat, whatever is relevant for you, you just go for it. That's great. Well, no judgment, well, no limitation. You just do what you want to do. You do you. But with the Xerxes model of pluralism, it's you have your God as long as you accept me as one of the gods. You can take me as one of the gods, then everything else will be fine. So the only thing you're not allowed to do is to claim that your God is the true God. That's the boat. That is out. That is off the menu. But if you're willing to say that your God is a lifestyle choice for you, that your God is a little part of your life, that your God is just a subsection, a subset of what you do, but functionally, you're just like everybody else. So pluralism says, everyone is welcome. We won't put you in jail for belief. We won't castigate you. As long as you conform to the general population, as long as you don't try to push your view on someone else, as long as you don't try to claim that what you have is fundamentally true. It's a private belief. You keep it like that. And that was the pluralistic Persian culture. It was vast and it was eclectic, and everyone was allowed to do what they wanted to do as long as they gave full allegiance to Xerxes as the ultimate god. After all, it did kind of defeat your god, so it's only fair and reasonable. But actually, the way that we see this culture represented in the pages of Scripture shows us where their real true allegiance was. And that wasn't just to Xerxes as a god emperor, it was materialism. So this is a materialistic society where success is measured in what you own. Success is measured in what you possess. Success is all about your wealth and how much you've accumulated. And the whole thing about Xerxes is he's saying, look, you've been assumed into the Persian Empire, but look how great it is. And so when he wants to demonstrate how good he shows off all his wealth, his fabulous material possessions. Because we live in a culture that they lived in 2,500 years ago, that what you have defines you, and what you have validates you. That your wealth and your positions are the ultimate status symbols of how worthy and how successful that you are. And we all bow down to those things and give them primacy in our lives. So it's materialistic, it's pluralistic, but it's also incredibly hedonistic. It's hedonistic in the way that it's a pursuit of pleasure. Actually, you may have your faith, but don't let it get in the way of you having a good time. You know, there's banquets all over the book of Esther. There's always parties. There's always drinking. There's always drunkenness. There's always excess. There's always people just living for pleasure. And our culture, if there was ever a hedonistic culture, we live in it today. And it says, listen, pleasure is the thing that everybody should live for. Doesn't matter what kind of job you do, as long as you've got enough money, wealth, possessions, so that you can enjoy, indulge, satiate every appetite, every desire, every urge that you have. You've got to fill those appetites. We live for the weekend. We live for pleasure. Where we think about anything, whether that's sex or whether that is ethics, we think in terms of what makes me feel good. If it feels good, do it. It's a hedonistic society. And when I read the book of Esther, I see the very same things. It's just they're coded in a different way. They're done in a mindset of ancient East. But actually, it's exactly the same things that we are wrestling with today. And Xerxes' whole thing is, look at this empire. Look at this way of life. Look at what we have created. I am a god amongst men, and see what I have wrought. But it doesn't work for everybody. Because if you pursue power, and if you pursue wealth, if you pursue pleasure, if you pursue hedonism, there are always winners and there are always losers. And in this case, Vashti, although she's not a person of faith, she's not counted in with the people of God, she is someone who just feels like, I am fed up of this. Yes, I have the wealth. Yes, I have the position. Yes, I have all these advantages and I have all this incredible good life that I enjoy, and I've got my seven eunuchs, and who, you know, what girl wouldn't want to have seven eunuchs? But something about this is just not working for me. You say, well, why did she not come when her husband just asked her to join the party? It's not unreasonable. You're throwing a party. You're married. You want your wife to come along. Hey, hon, say hi to all my friends and randomers that I brought into the citadel. What's wrong with that? Actually, it's a little bit creepy and it's a little bit dark, and it's completely the undertones in this. There are some scholars that think that when Xerxes said in his drunken stupor, rolling around like an idiot, when he said, bring her in with her crown, that he was saying, put a crown on her and nothing else. It's all about women being objectified by men. It's literally this woman to be shown off, to be humiliated in front of a bunch of baying drunken lads. And she says, I'm sick of it. I am fed up. I'm fed up of being an object on your arm. I'm fed up of carrying the title queen, but having none of the intimacy and the relationship that should go with such a thing. I'm just someone to be paraded. There's even the suggestion that there could be some kind of degrading sexual display that she's supposed to put on for these men. And she just says, look, you've got the power, you've got the hedonism, you've got the wealth, you've got this vast, incredible influence, but it's not working for me. And I'm not going to play this game anymore. I am out. And so what happens with Vashti is what happens very often in our own culture today. She's cancelled. She's banished. The advisors get together, they advise Xerxes, and they say, yeah, you can't put up with this because before you know it, women will be wanting rights and equality, and we can't have that. So get rid of her, make an example of her, strip her royal privileges from her, banish her, exile her, never see her again, make an example so that we nip this stuff in the bud. We've got to make it look that our society is still this wonderful utopia, even if it's more of a utopia for men than it is for the poor women that have to go along with it. And so that is the context of this book. Now we come across the people of God. And so we see this vast, sprawling empire that has taken over and dominated the world, led by this God emperor, this pluralistic, materialistic, hedonistic culture and society that looks enlightened and looks like everyone's winning, but even someone at the very heart of it says, I am not winning as much as you think I am. This stuff is not good for the soul. This stuff is toxic. It's corroding my self-worth, and I am out. So what do the people of God do? How do Christians, how do followers of God act in this kind of culture? Because it's our culture. And if we can see how they behave, we can get a bit of a sense of what we need to do as well. And this is where we meet the next character, Mordecai. It says this. Now there was in the citadel of Susa, a Jew of the tribe of Benjamin named Mordecai, son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, who had been carried into exile from Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, among those taken captive with Jehoiakim, king of Judah. So we're introduced to this guy, Mordecai, and he's supposed to be the hero. All these Jewish listeners, ancient Jewish listeners, been hearing the story of the king, the great Xerxes. And now the people of God come in, and they're on the edge of their seat. Tell us about him. And then these words come to introduce this character, and it is anathema. It's like the worst thing you ever heard. It's like, what? What kind of a story is this? First thing it says is, in the citadel of Susa. Now, a citadel was a mini city within the city. It was like a fortress, a stronghold within the city walls. So even if you breach the city walls, you can't get into the citadel. And there's plenty of times in ancient history where an opposing army got through the city walls, but they couldn't break into the citadel. If you've seen Lord of the Rings, the Two Towers, Battle of Helm's Deep, Alan's loving this. They break through the outer walls, but then they've got to do a whole other thing to break into the citadel, because the citadel is where they have their kind of fortress within a fortress. In other words, if you're in the citadel of Susa, you are looking to be at the very heart of empire, the heart of the godless empire that overcame the people of God. Instead of being opposed to it, and maybe you could live in the city, anyone that's in the citadel is someone that wants to be at the heart of political power and political operations. And for a Jew to be in the citadel of Susa is bad, bad news. It's like a betrayal of everything that you're supposed to be. You're compromised, you're flawed, you're sleeping with the enemy. But the second thing, even worse, his name, Mordecai. Now, Mordecai is a name taken, not like his father, his grandfather's great-grandfather, good Hebrew names. This is a Babylonian name, and it's the name of a Babylonian god. This is the god who is portrayed. It's the god Marduk. Mordecai, Marduka. In fact, people wondered whether this was a fictional story. And then around about 100 years ago in the 1920s, some archaeologists in Persepolis uncovered this carving. And it recorded the officials in the time of King Xerxes, particularly in the early part of his reign. Marduka came up. Marduk was the chief god of the Babylonians that were conquered by the Assyrians. And so Mordecai, it's almost like he's left his Jewish roots behind. He's now not even pretending to be a Jew. He's in the citadel, in with the political kind of core of the empire, and he's defined himself with a foreign god. It is shocking. It's like a pastor of a church naming their baby kid Satan. It just feels wrong. It feels like this is a betrayal of everything that we're supposed to be believing and following in. Now, I gave you a little portrayal of Xerxes just to help modernize it. This is my portrayal of Mordecai. It's Del Boy from Only Fools and Horses. In other words, someone that's a bit of a schemer, ducking and diving, someone that's trying to get graft, move forward. Someone who is morally flexible, a lovable rogue. Someone who's always trying to get an angle, a scam, in order to make it big. An aspirational person that wants to move beyond where they started. That's Mordecai. And it has another person, and this is the person that the book is named after. Now, it moves on. It says, let's read the next bit. Mordecai had a cousin named Hadassah, whom he had brought up because she had neither father nor mother. This young woman, who was also known as Esther, had a lovely figure and was beautiful. Mordecai had taken her as his own daughter when her father and mother died. So this is the girl with two names. If Mordecai's character and definition is firmly in the camp of idol worship and idolatry, Marduka, then Esther's kind of between. Esther's a little bit like me and you, in that she is kind of half defined by her Jewishness and half defined by her cultural context. And so this name, Hadassah, and Esther. Esther means Ishtar. It's just another version of the word Ishtar. So Esther, Ishtar. Ishtar was the goddess of sex and love. She was the sex, love, god. And Esther is named after her. But also her name is Hadassah. And Hadassah means myrtle. But there's a play on words that means it's hidden. So when you hear the word Hadassah and you're an ancient Jew, it's like a kind of little pun. And you think, ah, hidden. So on the one hand, she's got the character of someone who is modeled and defined by an Assyrian goddess, a sex goddess. Big surprise. In fact, I was going to put a picture of Ishtar on, but it was way too rude, not PG-13. But on the other hand, she's got this hidden identity. And the first thing is that she's hidden as a Jew because nobody knows that she is a Jew. She's got this Babylonian, Persian identity, this Assyrian identity. And yet at the same time, she's got this reality that she's Jewish. So she's Persian looking, Persian sounding, but Jewish on the inside. And she's able to kind of walk into these two worlds. Let's just back up a bit, because I want to tell you that these individuals, they have a kind of moral quandary. How do you handle a culture which is so powerful, so vast, so all-encompassing? How do you handle it as one of the people of God? So you can have assimilation, or you can have isolation. Isolation is what most Jews wanted. They wanted you to have a kind of sense that we're separate. We're God's people. We don't do what everyone else does. But Mordecai and Esther, they go down the route of assimilation. When I was growing up as a Christian, one of the issues that I had, this is going to sound a little bit crazy, but one of the issues that I had was I was so assimilated into my culture. I fit in so well. I was like Esther. I was a hidden believer. You didn't know that I was the Christian. You know, my friends, they use kind of crazy language. I swore like a sailor just to be part of the crowd. You'd never know from my language. You'd never know from the kinds of things that I did, the way that I lived my life. You'd never know I was a Christian. Apart from, I have a little bit of Jesus in my back pocket for Sundays and Wednesday evening when I do my midweek stuff. The rest of the time, just like everybody else. And I had this moment when I thought, actually, I've been assimilated. I need to be isolated. And I remember for me, and again, this is going to sound a little bit funny, but I remember I was way into music. I used to play in bands, and all my friends, we would just gather together and light joss sticks, and some of them would smoke some stuff, and we'd listen to music, and got really into some deep, you know, heavy rock, Led Zepp, Black Sabbath, Iron Maiden, all the kind of great bands of the 80s, 90s. Everyone's looking at me blank. I feel like I just lost the room. But yeah, you're aware thank you. That's good. I've got some peers. Thank the Lord. People who understand. Good old-fashioned Black Sabbath. And I can remember being so challenged and thinking, well, I've been assimilated. I need to isolate. In fact, I need to cut myself off from all of that stuff and just be a good Christian. And I remember going into my garage with a pile of records under my arm. Like I said, it was the 80s. And a hammer in the other hand. And then I came out from the garage with the hammer and a bunch of shards. And I just obliterated everything. And from that moment on, I'm only listening to Christian music. I only go to Christian holiday camps. I only hang out with Christians. I only read Christian books, listen to Christian worship. And all my life is Christian. Just drink milk from a Christian cow. Everything is all Christian. It's all just in that world, isolated. And that is the kind of the moral quandary. Because most of the Jews, they wouldn't go near the citadel of Susa. They were isolated. They wouldn't touch your banquet. Like Daniel, it's like, no, give me vegetables. I'm good. They're isolated. They're distinct. They are in their own little world, in their own frame. But Esther and Mordecai, they're completely assimilated. Now, this is what happens at the start of the book. We've had this thing with Xerxes where he's had this conflict with Vashti. And she just lets in the crack. You see, oh my goodness, it's not all great in this fairy tale kingdom of Persia. And so she gets off. Now, this is like 3 years later. It's after the Persian-Greek War. And you have a situation where Xerxes doesn't have his wife anymore. He doesn't have his queen anymore. And so a bunch of advisors say, do you know what you should do? And this will really cheer you up from losing the war to all those Greeks and their loincloths. He says, you should just put out that any young, beautiful virgin should be yours for the taking. And we'll gather them from all four corners of the empire, bring them to you. You can try them out one after the other each night, try a different one. And then when you find one that's particularly good, you can make her queen. You can use her as much as you like. And that's the call that goes out. And Mordecai with Esther, they get caught into that. So it goes on. When the king's order and edict had been proclaimed, many young women were brought to the citadel of Susa and put under the care of Hegai. Esther also was taken to the king's palace and entrusted to Hegai, who had charge of the harem. She pleased him and won his favor. Immediately, he provided her with her beauty treatments and special food. He assigned to her 7 female attendants selected from the king's palace and moved her and her attendants into the best place in the harem. And so what happens is that instead of Mordecai resisting like Daniel would resist, or Meshach, Shadrach, and Abednego, all people in exile, all good Jewish people, they resisted. Instead of him resisting, he hands over Esther. You know, they were looking for young, beautiful virgins. He could have easily just married her on the spot. She's his cousin. You know, maybe we don't quite marry our cousins, but they certainly did. It was like a fine thing to do. Both are married. I could just take her in. Or he could just fake it. Yeah, she's married. Sorry, young, beautiful, but sorry, she's married. So that one is off the table. They could have done that. They could have resisted. But there's something about Mordecai that says, interesting. Do you know what? Esther, you're absolutely brilliant. You're the kind of person that is so charismatic. You're like the idealized version of a woman that every man seems to respond to. You could do well here. I mean, on the other hand, you could get cast aside like all the other women in the harem, and then you're just consigned to a life of misery and sexual slavery in the harem. But, you know, it's a risk. You can't make an omelette without breaking a few eggs. But you could have an opportunity. You could get forward. Just don't ever tell anyone that you're Jewish. Just continue with this compromised, hidden lifestyle. And so he delivers her up. Esther had not revealed her identity and family background because Mordecai had forbidden her to do so. Every day he walked to and fro near the courtyard of the harem to find out how Esther was and what was happening to her. And then it goes on. When the turn came for Esther, the young woman Mordecai had adopted, the daughter of his uncle Abihail, to go to the king, she asked for nothing other than what Hegai, the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the harem, suggested. And Esther won the favor of everyone who saw her. She was taken to King Xerxes in the royal residence in the 10th month, the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. Now the king was attracted to Esther more than to any of the other women, and she won his favor and approval more than any of the other virgins. So he set a royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. And the king gave a great banquet, Esther's banquet, for all his nobles and officials. He proclaimed a holiday throughout the provinces and distributed gifts with royal liberality. So this is kind of the setup of our story. And next week, we're going to look. In fact, next week, we're going to find an alternative to assimilation or isolation. There's a third way. Next week, we're going to find out what changes these characters. But here is a little roundup before we bring this into land. First of all, these are the characters. You've got Xerxes, who's the god emperor. He represents a pluralistic, materialistic, hedonistic culture that has all the power, that holds all the cards, that defines how we're going to do life, demands allegiance, but there's a veneer of an enlightenment. And then we've got Mordecai, who's this chancer who is deeply compromised, deeply flawed, not above using his own cousin to try and push his own agenda into furthering his place in the court. And then you've got Esther, part of a harem now, but Esther has one really great ability. She can make men like her. She's just the kind of figure that men respond to. And it's not just her looks. There's something about her that makes her very, very easy to like. People are falling over themselves to please her and to be with her. And she's leveraging that power. So who's the hero of this story? Who's the one that you really want to be like? See, when we have Daniel, we have a character that we can think, dare to be a Daniel. He stands up against the culture. He forces his faith to the fore. He's able to stand on his own feet. But these guys, who do I identify with? But the fact of the matter is this. I believe that Esther is a book for us because I believe that Esther is so much more relevant to where most of us are at. I mean, be honest. How many of you feel like a Daniel right now? Strong, uncompromising, forthright, able to stare death in the face if that's what it takes to hold on to my faith. How many of us feel like that? Or how many of us feel like Esther and Mordecai? Like it's just so hard to keep your faith and integrity when the whole culture is against it. How many of us feel like Esther and Mordecai that you've made compromises and that you have your identity in faith is a part of you, but it's a hidden part, because that's Esther's name. She's hidden. Her faith is hidden. Her belief is hidden. And her practice is all over the shop. This is a woman that sleeps her way to the top. Not necessarily because she has to, but because she's forced into this situation. But at no point does she say, no, you cannot buy my integrity. I stand firm. She says, oh, okay, if you want. Vashti says, I'm not playing this game. Esther says, Yeah, sure. I'm in. I'll play. Tell me what the king likes. Okay, how can I get on him? How can I favor him sexually? How can I fulfill his desires? Make me the dream girl. She's like Katniss in the Hunger Games. And she's got the guys saying, okay, this is how you win. This is how you get favored. This is how you get people to like you. Let me pamper you. Let me create an outfit for you. Let me coach you. And she takes all of that and says, right, sure, I'm going to win these games. Vashti doesn't want it. Well, I'm in and I will do it. And she actually wins. But here's the thing, and we're going to pray with this. The character you do not see is the character who is hidden. When Esther's name means hidden, it's a play on words for hidden. It's not just her faith that's hidden, but it's God that's hidden. And God, who is hidden, whose name doesn't even appear in this book, is working behind the scenes. And next time we're going to see how God moves things just gently but surely so that these guys begin to reconnect with the faith that they had lost. Esther is a woman who's lost so much, a woman who's been abused, objectified, used, who's been put in an impossible situation. This is a woman that could have every right to say, where is God? I mean, we've been in this exile for 100 years. I've never even seen this country that's supposed to be a promised land. I don't have any relationship with God. Esther's the person that we identify with when we've lost faith. S is the person that we identify with when we can't find God. S is the person that we identify when we feel broken. We feel we've been put in difficult situations. We feel out of our depth. And S is the person that we identify with when we know that we've broken and we've compromised and we have crossed lines we never thought we would cross. And God says, yes, all of this is true, but I'm still able to use you. There are people in this room and you feel like, oh, I'm kind of disqualified from being used by God. And God says, no, I use and don't give up on people like this. I'm able to produce a pathway for you to find your true identity. Who do you think you are? Do you think that you're Ishtar or do you think that you're Myrtle, the one of righteousness? I'm able to use you. In fact, Esther sees more people saved than Daniel ever does. You can argue that Esther's impact on the nation of Israel is profound. It's way greater. In fact, we're going to see later on how an entire revival and reformation, a whole festival, there's never a new festival. Esther institutes a brand new festival. She has a profound impact on faith that even Jewish people today are remarkably impacted by. And the message is this. God can use flawed people. God can use the grandchildren of the exile in order to bring his grace, his mercy, and his love. So this is a story of hope in amongst the compromise. It's a story of purpose and grace in amongst all the brokenness and the mistakes and the questionable choices. But it's our story, and it's a story that gives us tremendous hope. Let's pray. Father, I want to pray that you'd help us. Lord, I thank you for the story of Esther. I thank you that the Bible isn't full of people that are perfect. It's full of people that are broken, that are hurting, that are doubting, that are compromised. Lord, people just like us. But I thank you that you're always working behind the scenes, that you have still plans for us. You have a purpose for us. You have a place for us. We can still impact history. We can change the world, even if we didn't have the very best start. And I want to pray for all of us, Lord. I want to pray particularly for those that feel like you're hidden from them. I want to pray for everyone struggling with their faith right now. I want to pray that you would show yourself as a God who may seem absent and hidden, but is there all the time. Lord, would you help us? In the name of Jesus, I pray. Amen.